Hello, I'm Bob Welch. This is number 0459, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0459. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, writer and dear friend Stephen Paul Leyva, the author of Made on the Moon.
Made on the Moon is essentially the story of a man named Stanley Lewis, who, as he states at the outset, had wanted to go to the moon from the time he was an infant. Not a child, but an infant from the time he was a little babe in his mother's arms.
And speaking of moon, we remember astronaut Alan Bean, who recently passed away. He was the fourth man to set foot on the lunar surface. How does going to the moon change a person?
I think it doesn't change a person so much if it sort of reveals them. I don't think most of the astronauts really changed. They just became more like they were. The ones that were religious sort of became more religious. The ones that were non-religious became more non-religious. I've noticed that in myself, too. And I noticed, too, that for me, I became a lot happier with being on Earth. I mean, I don't complain about traffic jams. I'm just glad I'm here.
Sam Kleiner is the author of The Flying Tigers, the untold story of the American pilots who waged a secret war against Japan.
In my academic work, when I was doing my PhD at Oxford, I just fell in love with this period in history right before World War II, with this debate around isolationism and Roosevelt's trying to figure out how he's going to help the Allies while still keeping us out of war. And that's really where the true story of the Flying Tigers comes from. It's a covert mission authorized at the highest levels of the Roosevelt administration to assist China by sending over planes and pilots before Pearl Harbor.
And there's lots and lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0459, was Bob Welch, a former broadcaster and a freelance voiceover artist who hails from the Green Mountain State. Thank you very much, Bob, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Okay, this has to be one of the dumbest stories that speaks volumes about our society today. While doing the paperwork at a car dealership in West Palm Beach, Florida, to buy a Fiat, Marcy Robbins says the sales rep put one extra piece of paper in front of her. It was the printed-out reCAPTCHA, as often seen online. You know, those little boxes that you have to tick. He wanted her to use a pen to check the box to confirm that she is not a robot. Robin, who is a magazine writer, was fairly incredulous, but the rep was serious. He handed me that page, which literally had nothing else on it, and just matter-of-factly said, "And this one is to ensure that you're not a robot," she says. She took a photo to document the request. A dealer employee confirms it's common practice to get customers to check the box. On the other hand, the sales rep said, even if she was a robot, he'd sell it a car, if it had a social security number and an ID. Seriously? So, he'd sell a robot a car if it had a social security number and an ID. Okay, anybody listening to this who knows of a robot with either a social security number or an ID? Let me broaden that question. Anybody know a robot looking to buy a car? Still not broad enough? How about, anybody know a robot? 27-year-old Caden John Minto pleaded guilty to burglary and blackmail after stealing a human skull and bones as well as ceremonial knives and robes from the temple of a Masonic lodge in Nelson, New Zealand. After the theft, Minto negotiated the return of the items in return for 7 grams. The Southern Star Lodge didn't quite understand the demand and decided he meant 7 grand, as in $7,000. No, Minto later admitted he meant 7 grams of meth. He was easily caught because he was doing the negotiation via Facebook using his real name. The stolen items were recovered by police and returned to the lodge, and Minto is being held in jail pending sentencing. Now, you're probably asking yourself, why isn't this guy in the running for Idiot of the Day? Well, there's a simple answer to that. Meth is involved. May I remind you that I usually rule out people under the influence of alcohol or drugs for the honor. I'm only looking for natural idiots, those who don't require enhancement. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Stephen Paul Leyva has been on the show several times. We've talked about script writing, we've talked about books, we've talked about comedy. This time around, we talk about a new novella that he has just released as an ebook. It's called Made on the Moon. Steve is on the line right now from California to tell us about it. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us.
You're more than welcome.
It's interesting that we're talking about the moon here because, as you know, and I have to thank you, by the way, full disclosure, you wrote a very nice piece about my book on your blog, which I very much appreciate. But
well, you know, I can be nothing but honest.
But one of the things about that is that recently, this past week, we lost one of those two men on the moon that I referred to in my book, Alan Bean. So on this very show, we're playing an interview that I did with Alan back in 1999. So it's interesting that we're talking about the moon with him and we're talking about the moon with you. So tell us about this novella.
That's interesting, but he actually made it, didn't he?
Yeah, but only one of 12, so very select group. So tell us about this Made on the Moon book of yours, the novella.
Well, Made on the Moon is essentially the story of a man named Stanley Lewis, who, as he states at the outset, had wanted to go to the moon from the time he was an infant. Not a child, but an infant, from the time he was a little babe in his mother's arms. And the way we tell the story is, it's very mysterious at first. You are in some kind of a facility, some kind of an institution. It's very gray. It's in a landscape that's very gray, and you don't really know what it is. All you know is that there's 3 interviewers who are not named except by the designations of R and S and T. And it's obvious that they've been there all day interviewing people that are at this institution. They're tired. They have one more to interview. They argue a little bit about should we, you know, interview that one or not. And they finally do. And the last interview is with a man named Stanley Lewis. And he starts to, he's a strange little guy. He's very disingenuous at times with them, and other times he's brutally honest. But as they interview him in a very frustrating manner because of the way he acts, the story of his life comes out. And that story started the year he was born, 1949, which, oddly enough, is the same year I was born. And it stretches well past his 100th birthday.
Wow.
And he reveals a lot. But his main passion, the main thing he wants to talk about is the fact that he had always wanted to go to the moon from the time he was an infant. And the interviewers at first just don't want to talk about that. They're trying to find out something about him for some purpose they have, which you don't, the reader never understands until the end of the story.
Well, it's an interesting point. You say there are twists and turns throughout the novella, and I'm just wondering, as a writer, normally, do you know going into whatever it is you're writing, and you've written several short stories, you've written several novels, do you know where everything will end up before you start writing? Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I usually do. I mean, you have some endpoint in mind. Even if it's not completely clear, and even if that sometimes changes as you head towards it. But in this particular case, Maid on the Moon actually started life as a play, which I wrote and premiered at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in Scotland way back in 1996. And then we had a frustrating time here in America trying to get it produced. We almost got it off Broadway in a lovely production that was to star Paul Provenza. I think you're well aware of Paul.
Yes, yes.
We were going to have a nice, the beginning 4-week run there off Broadway in Manhattan. And then suddenly he got cast in a TV show, which was going to film in Vancouver. So that didn't happen. And then various other times, almost with the Steppenwolf Company, was interested for like 33 and a half seconds and some regional theaters, but they just never happened. So finally, because it's a story that's very dear to me, I wanted to get it out there, and I decided I would convert it to prose, which is my basic art. I'm basically a fiction prose writer.
Well, you say it's a very it's a very dear story to you. Why is that?
Well, what I've always said about it is the first half of the story is and can be regarded as autobiographical. The second half of the story, I hope, isn't. So that's why it's very dear, because almost literally myself as a child, I was fascinated by the moon. I wanted to go to the moon. There's scenes where you learn about Stanley on his lawn in his front yard with his dad's binoculars staring at the moon. He feels that the moon is almost he calls it his god at one point. And his great desire is to get there. Now, the problem, the sadness in a way, is that he has absolutely no ability to do that. He doesn't have the wherewithal to become an astronaut. He doesn't have the kind of mind where he's going to do well with astrophysics or math or engineering or whatever it took in those days to become an astronaut. And in those days, as you know, most of them had to be pilots. I think Alan Bean was the first scientist, wasn't he?
No, that's actually Harrison Schmitt was the first scientist.
That's Harrison Schmitt, yeah. Okay. So most of them were pilots. That's what they started out with. He didn't have the ability to do that. But as he conveys his story to the interviewers, you find that certain potential ways to get to the moon occur to him. They are potential, but for him, they're unrealistic. But he strives mightily to do it that way, constantly failing. But this great desire, this core of his existence, to want to go to the moon, never fails him and never fades. Mm. And then as we get to the end of the story, things are resolved, but I won't reveal that here. Because you want the reader to discover that on their own.
Absolutely. Well, I read a review of the novella, and it likened it to a Twilight Zone episode. Another thing was mentioned in the review was Ray Bradbury, who is somebody you not only wrote about yourself in the past, but you knew quite well. And I'm just curious to know if any of those things... either Ray Bradbury or, you know, the Twilight Zone of your youth, or if any of those things influenced your writing of this story?
Yeah, I would have to say so. One, any person of my generation who grew up in the 50s and 60s and wanted to become a writer, especially if they had an imagination that, you know, tended towards the more fantastic on occasion, Twilight Zone, I think, was a huge influence. And the first short stories I started to write when I was young were always Twilight Zone-like with the ironic endings and what have you. Until that review, I never really thought of Maid on the Moon as actually being in that ilk, if we can put it that way. But I suppose I'll take that as a compliment. And Ray, with his great desire to see mankind move out into space, which was a passionate desire, wasn't necessarily scientifically based, but it was a poetic and passionate desire, which is, I would say, pretty much as Stanley has. Because he also doesn't want to do anything more than go to the moon. He doesn't necessarily want to go to Mars or conquer the stars or anything like that. He's just focused, partly because he feels he doesn't feel that he belongs on Earth. Somehow he feels he belongs on the moon. Now, this is both literal to him, but I think we can also take it as metaphorical about anyone who has a passion or doesn't feel comfortable where they are. So they want to move out west, is a good way to put it. And it is that figures into the story because, like myself, Stanley was born in California and grew up here, which was the end point of all Western migration of especially European civilization. And as he says one point in the play, I think, you know, there was nowhere to go but up except for the Pacific Ocean, and he didn't know how to swim.
Well, we've got less than a minute to go here. I just want to ask you, this started out as a play. It's now a novella. With you bringing attention to it in the prose form, is there a possibility that it could see it, it could work its way to the boards once again, or finally?
Well, that would depend on someone reading it and getting excited about it. We've had several good readings of it in the past, including with two actors from the different Star Trek series. Both of them played doctors. We had Robert Picardo and John Billingsley do a nice staged reading of it that I directed at the Writers Guild. And in fact, John Billingsley was very kind to give me a advance praise blurb for the novella. Sure, I'd love for that to happen. But, you know, that's up to the fates and all that.
In the meantime, how can people get their hands on it?
They can get their hands on it through any online bookseller, Amazon being the biggest. It's only $3.99 as an ebook. There's no plans at the moment to have a print edition, but there may be. I've talked to the publisher about that. It may be put together with a short novel of mine called Imp and publish the two together in print. But for the moment, it is as an ebook.
The book is...
And Amazon is your best place.
The book is Made on the Moon, written by Stephen Paul Leyva. Steve, thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you, Peter. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Author Stephen Paul Leyva, a great writer, an even better human being. His new novella is Made on the Moon. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0459, and you'll find links to Steve's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his ebook directly. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test leader.
And still to come on the program, we'll remember astronaut Alan Bean. Plus, we'll meet Sam Kleiner, the author of The Flying Tigers, the untold story of the American pilots who waged a secret war against Japan. We have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, and much more Stuff File news here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make the show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, making good on his promise, 43-year-old Welshman Mark Williams celebrated his third World Snooker Championship by conducting the post-match news conference at the Crucible Theatre in Sheffield, England, in the Buff. Williams, who beat John Higgins of Scotland on May the 7th, is the event's oldest winner in 40 years. I'm not going to say anything stupid, but to be honest, if I won this next year, I'd cartwheel down here naked, Williams promised. Well, he at least is someone who keeps his word. I've seen press photos of the conference, and he is indeed sans clothes. Now everyone will be waiting for next year to see if he wins and actually does those naked cartwheels. There's a press conference for the ages. In yet more naked news, the Daytona Beach International Airport was briefly evacuated early on May 11th when 25-year-old John Greenwood caused a ruckus as he rode around the baggage carousel in the Buff trying to get out onto the tarmac. Sheriff's deputies shocked him with a taser, to which he responded, "We gotta get out of here. There's a bomb going to go off. I planted a bomb in the bathroom." After sweeping the airport, officials found no explosives, but Volusia County Sheriff Mike Chitwood said they did find Greenwood's clothes in a backpack hidden in a hole in a bathroom wall. Described by Chitwood as a frequent flyer, Greenwood is known to local law enforcement, and he admitted taking drugs the night before. Okay, some people don't need a plane to be flying high. And come to think of it, what did the sheriff mean when he said frequent flyer? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next segment with me, Peter Anthony Holder, in Perth, Australia, a restaurant has taken a novel approach to an animal problem. Customers at Hillary's Three Sheets are being offered water guns to shoot at seagulls, which have been ruining diners' waterfront meals. "It was bad," owner Toby Evans said on May the 16th, admitting the idea was a desperate measure. Before, they'd wait until customers had finished and got up, but now they're getting cheekier and cheekier. Customers are on board, saying the pistols are working. You know, this could be turned into a contest. Perhaps free meals for how many birds you target. Heck, this could be a new game show. Welcome to Seagull Super Soaker. Yeah, anyway. Let's get to our next segment here on this edition of the Stuff File program. I've mentioned on several occasions in the past that my current book is out, entitled Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. Well, sadly, one of those two men on the moon recently passed away. Astronaut Alan Bean died on May 26th at the age of 86. I had the pleasure and honor to talk to Alan on a couple of occasions, most notably back on March 8, 1999. At the time, Alan, the fourth man out of only 12 to walk on the moon, was also the only artist to travel to the lunar surface, and we talked because he was promoting his excellent coffee table book of his work entitled Apollo, an eyewitness account by astronaut explorer, artist, moonwalker Alan Bean. Here is part of that conversation now.
I was looking through the book, and you know, a lot of us were aware of the fact while this was all going on, a lot of pilots, a lot of military people, astronauts going into space, going on to the moon, but I don't think a lot of us were aware of the fact that there was an artist amongst the group, and that artist was you.
Well, I wasn't completely aware of it myself, even though it was my hobby. I never thought of it as a profession. It was only after I got back from the moon and Skylab and others when I began to think about what might be a good thing to do next. And there were many, many astronauts at the office that could fly the space shuttle as good as I could or better, but there was no one interested in recording one of the great human adventures of all time.
It's interesting because, you know, when you think of the great explorers usually, and of course when the great explorers went in ships in most cases, so there was a larger crew, a larger complement, there was always somebody who went along who was an artist who would record and document in an artistic fashion what the journey explored. But that didn't happen with the moon, per se, because it was, you know, two-man crews, to say the least. But having you there and looking at some of the drawings you do in the book, it is absolutely breathtaking.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, I enjoy doing it, and it's the reason I became an astronaut, really, way back in 1963, was because I liked doing those things, and I liked the way the lunar module looked and the suits looked and felt, and so I noticed that when I'm painting them, I feel the same sorts of feelings going through my brain, that I like the looks of these, I like the look of the lunar dirt, things like that.
You were doing art before you went to the moon. I'm just curious to know, as someone who is artistic, how did going to the moon, that breathtaking vista that very few have seen, how did that affect your artwork after your return?
Well, first of all, I've always been a person that liked a lot of color. I'm very much like the Impressionist painter. Monet is my favorite artist. And so when I got back from the moon, people were saying, artist friends of mine were saying, why don't you paint the moon? And I'd say, well, look, the moon has got a gray surface and the sky is black and we're running around in white suits. I don't know. I don't know if you can do something like that and make it beautiful. But I realized that, you know, that was the scientist in me talking, and the technical observer talking, and then as I began to paint it, and I realized that I could change those colors a little bit, and I could make it, you know, as long as it still looked like an astronaut on the moon, I could explore some warm and cool colors and purples and blues and reds and oranges, and as long as I didn't make them too strong, it satisfied my artistic urge. So it took a little while to realize that the moon was good raw material.
The book, which also contains a narrative, is written by Andrew Chaikin, correct?
Yeah, Andy and I wrote it. I wrote all the stories as I did the paintings, because the paintings represent 17 years of artwork since I left the space program in 1981. And I wrote those stories as I did the paintings because I felt like, you know, most people really don't know what's going on in this exploration. It happened a long time ago. Half the people on Earth weren't even alive. So wrote those stories, and then Andy and I wrote together to sort of tie them all together with a narrative.
And if I'm not mistaken, was it not Andy's work that was the basis for that excellent HBO series From the Earth to the Moon?
You're absolutely right. Andy Chaikin is one of the reasons we asked him to participate in this book with us was he cares a lot about the space program, and he knows so much about it, as evidenced by his wonderful book, Man on the Moon, which may be the best inside book that's ever written about the space program, because he spent 10 years, interviewed most of the astronauts, and just cared deeply about it and recorded it in a wonderful way, and it became Tom Hanks's Bible, you might say, to make that series.
It's interesting that we have a chance to talk to you because of your artistic talent and showing us a different perspective of going into space and going to the moon. And the reason why I bring that up, I had an opportunity on another program to talk to Harrison Schmitt.
Oh, yeah, Jack Schmitt. Wonderful. Wonderful, but 100% scientist in his head.
Well, that's why I wanted to talk to him, because I was watching From the Earth to the Moon, the HBO series, and I just found the stories depicting the whole geological training that they had in the desert before they went to... I found that fascinating. And I think that it's a combination of learning about the science and what it took to get man to the moon from a scientific point of view, and also looking at it from your artistic point of view, that makes it more human for the average person. And I think it, both of them together... are two points that maybe give a reason as to why maybe we should spend the money and time and do this again.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And Jack Schmitt helped every crew. He was kind of a coordinator between the scientific community, the geologists, and the crew members. We were all test pilots and engineer types. We didn't know a lot of geology, and we didn't care about it like he did. And so he was able to kind of infuse some of that excitement about studying rocks and dirt and looking at topography and make it exciting to us. Not as exciting as it was to him. That's why it was so wonderful that it went. But flying was more exciting to us than it was to him. So it turned out to be a nice combination. Jack Schmitt made a great contribution to Apollo.
And that's exactly the point I'm bringing up here. And again, with your artwork, to a lot of people who were watching the Apollo missions, especially after some people became jaded, everyone watched when Neil went up because it was the first time, and there was great interest when you went up because it was the second time. But by the time it got around to Jack Schmitt in the last Apollo mission, people were thinking, you know, these are just flyboys going up to the moon, and some of them are playing golf, you know.
Well, that's right. Now that's interesting you should bring up the golf, because in light of what you said a little bit earlier, when I watched Al Shepard on Apollo 14 hit the golf ball, I thought, because of my mindset at the time, mentality, I thought, boy, he's wasting time. He should be picking up more rocks. He should be doing more geology. Here he is just hitting a golf ball. But after a few years, I began to say, you know, maybe we didn't do enough things on the moon in our exploration that were just human fun things to do. In fact, if I had it to do over again, if I could go back in time, which none of us ever can, and do it over again, Pete and I think would take a football. Now, I didn't think that when I watched Al do it. You know, it took a number of years afterward. We'd take a football, we'd get it, turn the TV on us, I'd say, go deep, Pete, and I'd throw him a pass, and maybe he'd punt it back. We'd get it on TV, and it'd be fun. Maybe the next crew would take a soccer ball and do the same thing. It would add things that human beings can relate to. They were having difficulty relating to all this science and technology because it's just complicated. That's all there is to it.
Besides affecting your artwork, how did going to the moon change you, if at all, as a human being?
Well, first of all, I think it doesn't change a person so much as it sort of reveals them. I don't think most of the astronauts really changed. They just became more like they were. The ones that were religious sort of became more religious. The ones that were non-religious became more non-religious. I've noticed that in myself, too. And I noticed, too, that for me, I became a lot happier with being on Earth. I mean, I don't complain about traffic jams. I'm just glad I'm here. if it rains today, I'll be happy. I was up in Boston just last weekend speaking, and it snowed in, and I heard people complaining, and I didn't even feel at all upset. I thought, wow, look at this white stuff come down. Just think, in the moon, they never have any of this. They never have any weather. They never have any clouds. They never have any trees. They never have any animals. And that's true for Mars, our next closest neighbor. And then after that, it's Venus, and it's like the moon with nothing going on except cloud cover. And then Mercury, and there's another place just like the moon except 400 degrees hot. We're living in the Garden of Eden. I've loved the Earth a lot and just been glad to be a human being, earthling. I feel good about that every day, to tell you the truth.
What's it like when you're standing on the moon? Actually, when you're leaving the planet, but even so, when you're standing on the moon, what's it like looking back at Earth?
Well, it's the most beautiful place you can see. I mean, everything else looks pretty much like it does from Earth. You know, you still can't see the planets. They're like, seem like morning stars or evening stars, and so you see those, the ones that are up. The Earth, though, the sun, by the way, just seems a little brighter, but because of the lack of atmosphere on the moon. But the main thing is, you just look at the Earth, and it's blue and white. And if you look away and look back at it in several hours, well, then it's rotated. You can't really see it's rotated, but you notice that the cloud patterns have changed. And maybe you can see a little orange down there that suggests that maybe that's a land area. If an alien came flying near our solar system in a spaceship, they would recognize the Earth as a place that had maybe an atmosphere and water, which suggests that maybe they could have life forms there. And they would want to come visit. They wouldn't go to the moon. They'd say, hey, there's another dead place over there. And how about Mercury? We don't want to go there. It's nothing going on there. And how about those outer planets? Well, they don't even have a hard surface we can walk around. But this blue dot over here, this tiny blue ball and white ball, you know, that's probably oxygen and hydrogen. And even though we don't have it on our planet, we could, you know, there could be life forms down there. We better go down there and see what's going on. Maybe there's some growing things, or maybe even maybe intelligent life. I don't know. So it's really the most beautiful thing in the universe when you're standing on the moon, the most beautiful thing you can see.
I know you're in pressurized suits when you're on the moon, but is it fair to ask how it feels or how it sounds when you're on the moon?
Sure, that's fair. When I was a youngster, I lived in Fort Worth, but my grandparents lived up in Michigan. So sometimes around Christmas, we would go up there and spend Christmas with them. And I can remember as a kid going out and playing in the snow, and my parents would put me in long-handled underwear and put my clothes on and maybe a sweater or coat. And then they'd put me in a snowsuit and then a hat and with earmuffs and gloves and mittens, and they'd send me out in the snow. And I can remember going out in the snow and standing in it, and not every part of me was warm as toast except my face, you know, the part that wasn't covered by the earmuffs and the hat. And that's kind of the way I felt running around the moon. Now, we had visors on our helmets, naturally, to hold the pressure. So my face was nice and cozy. So I was nice and cozy, not warm, not cool. I had a little control of my air conditioning, which was in the backpack. And I was just the right temperature. But as I walked around on the moon, I felt somewhat isolated from it, even though I knew that in the sunny parts of the moon, you know, it was up above 200 degrees. And if we went into the shadow of the lunar module and stood there a while, it would start getting real cold, colder than 100, minus 100. And so I didn't feel that in the suit, so I was somewhat isolated. And also, being in the suit with the gloves and somewhat clumsy, it keeps you from really feeling the dirt, it didn't feel like a beach. It felt more like walking through a plowed field where you've got to watch your step so that you don't step in a hole or in a furrow, or you sink in maybe an inch over left foot, and then your right foot goes and it sets on top, and then you put your left foot in a different place and it sinks in 2 inches. So you got to be careful you don't trip. That's sort of the effect it was.
That's absolutely fascinating to hear someone talk about walking on the moon, which is obviously something the majority of the planet will never have the opportunity to do.
Well, not now.
Not now.
I would say that maybe never the majority, but I would say within 500 years or less probably, we're going to have things on the moon where people will go there like we go to Disney World. And, of course, there'll be scientific outposts, and then eventually people will live there under big bubbles, and eventually the Olympic Games will be there and all this other stuff. But to begin with, people will, I think, start going there as a place to visit that would be fun. And so gradually more and more people from Earth will become familiar with the moon, just as from 1492 on, although it was slow at the beginning, more and more Europeans became familiar with the Western Hemisphere. It took 200 or 300 years to kind of get it going. Mm-hmm. But then once they got it going, look at it now. It's only been several hundred years, 300 or 400 years, and look at the travel now between the Western Hemisphere and the Eastern Hemisphere, and, you know, in Europe.
Now, again, so many of us never have an opportunity to see what it's like being on the moon. You're a person who has been there and done the artwork. We can take your word for it. The pictures are beautiful, but we can't vouch for how realistic they might be. Have you spoken to the other astronauts, your fellow moonwalkers, and have a reaction from them on your artwork?
Yes, it's sort of interesting, too. When I left the space program to be an artist, even though they knew that was my hobby, some of them thought I was having a midlife crisis or something. You know, they said, why would a guy leave being a wonderful astronaut and go try to be a starving artist or go be an artist? It didn't. To half of the people, that didn't make sense, you know, because they didn't think being an artist was worthwhile. Where the other half kind of thought, well, that'd be fun to do. Maybe I'd like to do it. So that was a mixed reaction when I left. Nowadays, where they've had the chance to see the art, and I'm doing something to preserve something that's very important to all of us, probably more important than other people, because we risk our lives to go do that stuff. That was that important to us. And so they like it. Now, they never do criticize it. They look at it, and they won't say, well, Al, you made the moon have a lot of purples and greens in it, and I don't remember that. They never say that, but of course it's true. I didn't see any purple and greens up there. But that artists are not scientists. Artists take, in the same way with Monet and Van Gogh and all the other artists take the raw material of reality, and then they do what they want with it, depending on what kind of artist they are, and make it into something else. That's the role. So one of the things I want to do is take my experience and the experience of the other astronauts and make it as exciting and beautiful as it felt to us, not necessarily how it exactly looked, but more how, you know, when I do a painting, it was a beautiful experience, and everyone that went to the moon will say that. Like Buzz Aldrin called it, magnificent desolation. Good word. So they always like them, and the more colorful I make them, the more they seem to like them, even though the reality of it is it was a gray and black world, period.
Well, I think your artwork, as you mentioned with some of your fellow astronauts, that they said that you added a bit more life to what was what was actually on the lunar surface. You have in some ways romanticized it and brought it to life, and who knows, I think maybe your artwork might actually inspire people, kids today who think, you know, maybe I would like to try and see what the moon is for myself, rather than seeing just the stark reality of the pictures that were taken.
I couldn't agree with you more. The reason I left the space program was to record this adventure for future generations. I'm not going to be around here another 20 years, and neither is anybody else that was there. This is all. If someone would say, what do you want to do with all those books? I'd say, take every one of those books and put them in a school library or a regular library, because I want kids to look at those paintings and be inspired and say, you know, when I grow up, I'm going to go back to the moon. Or when I grow up, I'm going to go to Mars and do some better geology than Alan Bean did. You know, I can do better than that. Or I'm going to, you know, maybe the books will be around even longer, and some of them will say, well, we've gone to Moon and Mars now, and the next step, we're going out and we're going to land on some asteroids in the asteroid belt. And you know, when I go there, I'm going to take a football like Al Bean wished he had and never even thought of it. You know, I'm hoping that these pictures and stories will excite young people, because, you know, that's who belongs to the future. They've got to go do their thing. They've got to go figure out ways to move civilization forward just like we did. And maybe they'll read the book and be inspired when they're young kids. I don't know. I hope so. Who knows what'll happen?
Well, it's a great book. The book is Apollo, an eyewitness account by astronaut, explorer, artist, moonwalker Alan Bean. There's a lot of hyphens there, but all well-deserved. And it's published by Greenwich Workshop Press. I thank you very much, sir, for being on the program with us.
My treat, and it's nice and refreshing to talk to someone that has the knowledge of the space program that you do. It's really nice.
Thank you. Take care, sir.
Bye.
That was astronaut and artist Alan Bean from a conversation we had back on March 8, 1999. He died on May 26th of this year in Houston, Texas. Some of his artwork is on display as large murals at Space Center Houston and at the Astronaut Hall of Fame at Cape Kennedy. If you haven't, I urge you to get his book, Apollo, an eyewitness account by astronaut, explorer, artist, moonwalker Alan Bean. It's a beautiful tome that is one of my prized possessions. Stuff File program fans, you can hear the full version of the conversation you just heard by going to our Patreon page and becoming one of the select patrons of the show. Just go to patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You can also find more with him and others in my book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. One thing I've learned after years of analyzing multi-million dollar legal verdicts and multi-billion dollar government budgets is this. Huge raw numbers mean virtually nothing by themselves. Unless they're put into context, it's impossible to understand the true significance of any number that ends in billion or trillion. For instance, the total cost of complying with all the federal regulations each year is estimated to be $1.9 trillion. But what does that really mean? Well, here's some perspective. When we look at the value of all the goods and services produced by every country around the world, only 7 countries have a GDP that exceeds the estimated cost of regulation in the United States. Let's be fair, that means it costs more for businesses, charities, and everyone else to comply with federal regulations than the value of everything created by Canada in 1 year. In other words, U.S. regulation is the 8th largest country in the world. Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming up a little later on in the show. I don't have any more Stuff File news to bring you on the program because we ran a little long with our Alan Bean segment just a few moments ago. An interesting man, a very, very interesting man indeed. He will be missed. One of only 12 to go to the moon, and now that he's gone, there are only 4 remaining. Anyway, so since we went a little long with that segment, we have no more Stuff File news. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, but what we'll do right now is we'll get straight to our next guest talking about the flying tigers. Author Sam Kleiner traveled around the United States to find the true story of the flying tigers, the famed World War II pilots. The result is the book The Flying Tigers, the untold story of the American pilots who waged a secret war against Japan. Sam joins us on the line right now from New York. Hi, Sam.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks for being on the program. Now, I understand from your perspective, you have a personal connection, a reason for wanting to tell this story, to write this book in the first place.
Yeah, well, I grew up with just a deep interest in World War II because my grandfather had been a navigator on a B-25 in the Pacific. And as a kid, I would go with him to the Pima Air and Space Museum where I grew up in Tucson, Arizona, and he'd tell me about the war. And so I always just had a deep interest in that, in the greatest generation, particularly the war in the Pacific. And in my academic work, when I was doing my PhD at Oxford, I just fell in love with this period in history right before World War II, with this debate around isolationism and Roosevelt's trying to figure out how he's going to help the Allies while still keeping us out of war. And that's really where the true story of the Flying Tigers comes from. It's a covert mission authorized at the highest levels of the Roosevelt administration to assist China by sending over planes and pilots before Pearl Harbor.
So having been steeped in the knowledge of this from your grandfather and your own interests and studies in this, when putting together this book, when you started to write Flying Tigers, was there anything in your research that was an aha moment or a surprise for you while putting it together?
Absolutely. The first real thing, so the Flying Tigers, I think a lot of listeners will recognize the famous image of the shark-faced plane, or will have seen the John Wayne movie, The Flying Tigers. It was made in 1942. And so I kind of had that familiarity with them. And then as I started to get into this research, I realized that there was an incredible human story, and that's really what this book is about the people behind this. So when I was at Yale, I found a trove of love letters, if you can believe it, between a nurse and a pilot in the Flying Tigers. And they had met on the ship over and fallen in love. And these were just incredibly personal letters of a romance blossoming in the extraordinary circumstances of the beginning days of World War II in this very famous unit. And I wanted to tell the human story of people like that. So what I started to do was going to the Flying Tigers reunions and meeting the families of these the Tigers to put together kind of the diaries and letters and photographs that allow for the true story of the Tigers, not the Hollywood stuff, to be told finally.
Now, as World War II gets further and further behind us in history, there are less people around who actually lived through the times. Did you manage to get in contact with anyone who was connected with the Flying Tigers?
Absolutely. So starting in the 1950s, these guys would have annual reunions. And those were kind of a chance for these guys to relive, you know, this kind of glory days from their youth, because they were so young when they were pilots. Those reunions are still going on, but now there's, for the most part, family members of the Tigers who attend them. And all of the Tigers, except for one man, Frank Lazonski, has since passed. And so I've become very close friends with Frank. He lives down in Columbus, Georgia. And just a few weeks ago, I was able to go down and see him and give him a copy of the book, which just meant the world to me to be able to assure him that the true story of his unit and their heroism was finally being written. And we had a chance to talk with CNN, which aired on Memorial Day. Which was really great for him to be able to get the acknowledgement that I feel he deserves.
You've talked to him. You've talked to other family members of those who are no longer with us. One of the things we often hear about war stories is that they fall into two categories. There are those who don't want to talk about the war, don't want to share their experience of it. They put it behind them. And there are those who openly want to talk about it. Would you say that the group that included the Flying Tigers were more of the talkative aspect? Considering, as you say, they even started annual gatherings.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, you know, this was definitely a group that was talkative in the sense that they, you know, they shared their experiences. But what I found was that when you had these letters and you had the diaries of these guys and the combat reports, and I spent years trying to track these documents down, it told a different story than you might get, you know, 30, 40 years after the fact, because the accounts of the time were basically just ordinary young men, you know, who wanted this wild adventure. One guy in his diary writes about getting on the ship, and it was the first time he'd been on a body of water bigger than a lake back in Iowa, where he was from. And they, expressed their fears and their concerns and, you know, kind of what they actually did. And so I wanted to capture that as much as possible, the true story of what it was like to be there, to give the reader a sense of that. And, you know, a lot of these guys would write memoirs, you know, 20, 30 years later. but that doesn't give you the real sense of what it was like to actually be there. So I think that my goal was this kind of authentic story, and I think I really got that.
Do you get a sense that, through their own words, do you get a sense of not only their heroism at the time, even if they might themselves not be completely aware of it, but also the fact that they were just kids?
Absolutely. You know, for so many of these guys, you know, they would write about going out and fighting the Japanese and then come back and wanting to have a beer. And, you know, this pilot from Iowa I talked about, Bill Reed, writes in his diary on Christmas about going out and fighting, but then, you know, coming back, and they all miss their parents. And so there's, you know, for many of them, this is the first Christmas they're spending away from home. So there's this amazing story there about, you know, just these ordinary Americans who became mythologized as heroes. You know, you have the John Wayne movie, and they become the front page news and all the stories back home. But that was really because America at that time really needed heroes they could look to after the loss at Pearl Harbor, a series of losses across the Pacific. There was a demand for, you know, good news stories, and the Flying Tigers were beating back the Japanese in China. And even if Americans couldn't pinpoint Kunming on a map, they knew that the Flying Tigers were heroes. But this is really a story about, you know, just how ordinary these extraordinary men were.
And in gathering the information, the letters and the diaries, and reading their individual stories, besides the fact that they were Flying Tigers, collectively, did you get a sense of the type of person that became a Flying Tiger in the first place?
It's a great question. And so many of these really kids were, you know, children of the Great Depression. They'd grown up in all over the country, but most of them had scarcely left the state they grew up in before they joined the military, and didn't really travel much before they signed up for the Flying Tigers. And in that time, you know, crossing an ocean was a huge undertaking, because there were no, most of these people hadn't traveled. So they were adventurers. They really were captured by this a love for flying, and a sense that this was going to be a great adventure.
It's interesting that you brought up the Depression, because I've always had the feeling that when one talks about the so-called greatest generation, as Tom Brokaw talked about, I think the greatest generation was molded by having survived the Great Depression as children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're definitely shaped by the Great Depression as they go into this. And for a lot of these guys, they have, the chance to make money with the Flying Tigers was also a part of that, because they hadn't grown up with that. So Frank Lozansky, who's this last surviving Tiger, it talks about, you know, how he grew up having to find coal kind of lying around the train tracks to heat their home growing up in Detroit. So there's so much, in that and the kind of character they had. But that also instilled in them this kind of can-do spirit. So when they were kind of basically behind enemy lines and had to keep fighting with the Tigers, there definitely was a spirit that they were just going to get the job done.
Is there a particular audience you were trying to reach when you first set out to write this book?
I think I want to make the book's written in a way where I want to make it as accessible as possible. So you don't need to know anything about World War II in China, or really even, you know, that much about World War II to enjoy it, because it's a great human story. And so I think with Father's Day coming up and the 4th of July, it's supposed to, you know, just be a book that talks about how America can be united. You know, these guys came from all over the country, all different walks of life. And there's a real great deal of unity in this unit, and something that I think we should preserve.
The book is called The Flying Tigers, The Untold Story of the American Pilots Who Waged a Secret War Against Japan. Sam, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you so much.
Sam Kleiner, author of The Flying Tigers, The Untold Story of the American Pilots Who Waged a Secret War Against Japan. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0459, and you'll find links to Sam's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A woman came up with a get-rich-quick scheme in order to make a lot of money from an insurance company. 29-year-old Coriel Bradley of Louisiana went to the Mercy Regional Medical Center for treatment after suffering a cut to her mouth. Bradley claimed that she bit into a sandwich, which she bought from a fast food restaurant, and injured her mouth. She said that she found a razor blade in her food when she got home. She then filed an insurance claim with the restaurant's insurance company and contacted a personal injury attorney about representation. When police examined the razor, it looked new and did not appear to have been mixed with other food from her sandwich. Officers checked with the hardware store near the restaurant, who sold the same razors. While reviewing store surveillance videos, detectives saw Bradley grabbing a pack of razor blades from the shelf and leaving without paying for them. Furthermore, security video from the restaurant proved that no one placed any contraband into Bradley's sandwich. So far, Bradley was arrested for criminal mischief and theft. So clearly, we're not dealing with a razor-sharp mind here, because why, oh why, would you think you could get away with such an easily provable case of insurance fraud against a fast food restaurant by stealing razor blades from one establishment to put into the food of another? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0459. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And once again, that's 0459. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.